for a word podcast is brought to you by Naked City Brewery.
Well, hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 182 in what has now officially become a long and drawn-out series. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Boom, indeed. Wow. Legion of Boom, indeed, my friends. Of course, I do live in Seattle. We do this show from Seattle. And it's no secret that the Seattle Seahawks played in the Super Bowl this evening and totally owned it. Woo! I've never been so excited for a sport game. See? That's how much I know about sports. I've never been so excited for a football game. It's fantastic. It feels great to be on the winning side. Finally, for once, by the way, this is the first ever, time that the Seahawks have ever won the Super Bowl. So fantastic, man. It was amazing. Almost a complete blowout of sorts. I'm almost going to have a complete blowout, and the game was almost a complete blowout at the same time. Get it? I did. I ate a lot of crap today, but it was fun. It was a great time. Yes, and I'm still on kind of a high about it. I mean, the city is going nuts. This city is so excited to have a winning team right now. This whole season has just been fantastic, and it's made me very, very proud. I mean, there's a lot of great things that have been going on in Seattle lately, to tell you the truth. Grammys. Right, Macklemore and Ryan Lewis brought home a bunch of Grammys this year. And Seahawks go to the Super Bowl. I mean, come on. Fantastic. We legalized gay marriage. We made marijuana legal. A lot of good stuff happening in Seattle right now, folks. I'll tell you what. Okay, we have got just a fantastic show planned for you today, folks, this week. I met today, this morning, pre-Super Bowl, went out towards downtown Seattle at the base of the shaft of Capitol Hill and talked with Kevin Allison, who was an actor that was part of the comedy troupe The State on MTV, a part of the sketch show. And now he does his own podcast called Risk, True Stories Boldly Told. True Tales Boldly Told, sorry. Part of the Maximum Fun network run by Jesse Thorne. This guy is great. I have been a fan of Risk for a long time. I've also been a fan of The State for a long time. I remember the first time I ever saw The State, and I tell this story to Kevin as well. It's like when the first time I saw it, like, I didn't have cable. So my friends would always come to school, and they would always tell me about this new show, The State, right, that was on MTV, but I couldn't see it. And finally, I caught one sketch that has been burned in my memory, as it probably is burned in a lot of people's memory that are the same age as I. And it's the guy at the party who says, I'm going to dip my balls in it, right? And, they just keep on passing him things, and he just screams, I'm going to dip my balls in the peanut butter, in the dip, whatever. He's the life of the party, right? At least that's how I remember it. It's probably totally opposite of that. But that's, like, it was burned in my memory, and I said to myself, oh, my God, what is this? I need to see more of it, right? Yeah. Yeah. And Kevin was part of that. And he tells the tale of how he became involved in that whole deal, the rise and the fall of Kevin Allison. And also he talks about coming out as a gay man. And it's a man, just a fantastic conversation. Fantastic conversation. But while we were talking, let's see, we went to a musical break and then we came back. And Kevin had gotten this tweet on his phone or some sort of thing. Maybe it was like just a notification from like Huffington Post or whatever, that Philip Seymour Hoffman had passed away. That was he was found dead this morning, man. And it was a weird feeling. It was, you know, I don't know him, obviously. You know, I've never met Philip Seymour Hoffman, but like many who I'm sure listen to this show, or I said that wrong. Like many who listen to this show, I was a big fan of his. I was a big fan of Philip Seymour Hoffman's movies. I think he was one of the best actors of my lifetime. And I think a lot of people would agree with that. That the guy was amazing. He never did anything really that struck me as a bad role, right? Even in that Mission Impossible movie that he was in, he was fantastic. He was menacing in that movie. It was so real when he played that. And I'm using this one as you know, I'm using this as an example because that was not the greatest of movies, but he made that role. He made that movie work. He made that bad guy feel really, really twisted and bad, man. I mean, he was good. He was good at what he did. And I was thinking because, you know, there's this stuff that has come up with, come back up with about Woody Allen, right? Woody Allen accused of sexually molesting his, I don't know what you would call it, his, you know, girlfriend's daughter, I guess. A lot of people don't know this, but he was never married to and never even really actually lived with Mia Farrow. So technically that wasn't his daughter, but anyway, that you know, semantics. I mean, if he molested that girl, that's awful. Which gets me to my point is like these famous people, right? I mean, Philip Seymour Hoffman addicted to heroin, nobody really knew, right? But like I guess it doesn't really surprise me. I mean, they're just people, right? People are walking fallacies. We can't do right all the time. And famous people aren't above that, right? Real sad story. I don't even know why I brought Woody Allen into that. I guess that one was fresh on my mind too because I was just disgusted with that story that came out. Dylan Farrow, who wrote a little bio piece on you know, why she thinks Woody Allen is you know, a piece of shit, to say the least, right? And it was a hard editorial article to read. It was really, man, ugh, yeah, gross. If he really did that stuff, that's disgusting, and you know. He shouldn't be held in such high regard. I agree with that. I agree with that. Wow. I really am just, I'm still a little drunk, people. I'm still high on the Seahawks winning the Super Bowl, and I'm still low on Philip Seymour Hoffman dying today. And man, just a whole range of emotions, and I can't keep them all straight. So what's new, right? Anyway, hey, before we get to our first musical break, I want to remind you guys that we're throwing our first ever Air Raid Live podcast with some very, very special guests. Comedian Derek Sheen, who has toured with Patton Oswalt, opened for Brian Posehn, and toured with a lot of these big names. You know, he does comedy with the likes of Dana Gould and all those guys, you know. Great dude. He's from here in Seattle. He's been on the show a couple times. Good friend of mine, and he's fantastic. So he's going to be there doing some stand-up for us. Also, the band The Young Evils is going to be there. So you're not going to want to miss out on this live show. It's March 29th, Saturday, March 29th at 9 p.m. Tickets are going to be $4. I think, yeah, $4. $4. That's really cheap. Plus, we've got another special guest that we can't announce yet, but it's going to be awesome. You will know her name. Oops, did I say too much there? You will know its name, and you will think it's great. It is great person. There you go. The first ever live Air Raid podcast. Tickets are going to go on sale soon. We'll make sure to, you know, blast that out on the Twitter and the Facebook, which you can find us at there, Air Raid Podcast and Air Raid Net on Twitter. So yeah, we'll let you know when that is coming down the pipes, people. Air Raid Live. I know I said it was going to be free earlier, but we decided that we couldn't do that because it's actually ending up costing us a lot of money. So we thought, you know, $4, it will help us, like, you know, soften the blow of the money that we need to put out for the show. So that's it. And I think it's going to sell out really fast. So keep an eye out. And when those tickets go on sale, get them while they're hot, okay? That's going to be at Naked City Brewery in the screening room, which is a nice, big, comfortable room, at 9 p.m. Saturday, March 29th. So, yeah, keep your eyes and ears open for when those tickets go up. $4, people, not a lot of money. Derek Sheen and the Young Evils. You can't even see the Young Evils in Seattle for, you know, less than like $17. So come one, come all. Special show. Okay, let's do this. We're going to be featuring music today by the band Neighbors, a local Seattle band. They've got some new music coming down. This is from album that they came out with last year called Power Country. This song is called Home, and when we return, we'll be talking with Kevin Allison of The State and The Risk Podcast. So stay with us, won't you? All right. Neighbor, Home. We'll be right back. We can learn to compromise. You'll get everything that you wanted. You'll get everything that you wanted. So don't you tell me I don't really care. Don't tell me I don't really care. Don't tell me I don't really care. Oh, it's so hard to explain it, guys. When I want advice, 'cause I don't really know about these things. And you know it's a shame to let you go. But doing this type of thing just feels weird. Like when I tell people that I'm going to Kevin Allison's hotel to do a podcast, I'm half ashamed. Do you feel the same way? Like you have a pretty successful show, but it's still a podcast,
oh,
right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And this hotel that we're in right now, I feel, is what it reminds me of is a place that should charge by the hour.
Because it's so close. It's because it's so close to the highway. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And there's just a certain smell about it, you know, that sort of thing. We might find out we have crabs after leaving here.
Right. Just from sitting on this office chair that I'm occupying here. Yeah, I mean, well, you should have seen this hotel before.
Oh, yeah?
Like 10 years ago, this hotel was pretty janky.
Oh, wow.
To use a hip term.
Yeah. This is the janky hotel.
right.
Yeah, no, that's on that subject. That is something that really does get to me quite a lot, is that people like to use the word podcast kind of ironically, as if, well, they're, you know, like, I know that the last time I sat down with the iTunes guys and talked to them, they said that there were 250,000 at that point that were currently active in iTunes.
Right, yeah.
And so it feels like, you know, oh, everyone's got a podcast. Who cares about a podcast? But I am very, very, very passionate about audio as being what I find the most compelling and interesting way to share content with people. I grew, when I was a kid, I was just obsessed with records. And I used to love to listen to, like, sketch comedy kinds of albums, too, like Monty Python.
Oh, yeah.
Free to Be You and Me and all that kind of stuff. And I used to make little radio, you know, fake radio dramas when I was a kid on,
really?
On the tape recorder. Yeah. And I really enjoyed making the States album. So I'm a part of me is a little bit ashamed of the fact that it took me so damn long to realize I should be doing a podcast. Yeah. And I also feel that, you know, like, the troubling thing for me about Risk is it's really, really hard to communicate to people what the show is and that it's special.
Right.
People really have to kind of pay attention to at least a couple of episodes to get it. You can tell people, oh, it's like The Moth, only much more uncensored. Or there are some things that are like This American Life with the sound design and the music, but they get a little bit more intimate and deep and, you know, like really into your psyche. But people are just like, uh-huh. They don't process.
They don't get it until they hear it. Yeah.
They got to hear it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's upsetting that so many people still don't even know what a podcast is. And then it's upsetting that people who do know what podcasts are listen to The Moth and This American Life and have no idea that Risks exist.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We were at the Stitcher Awards, or I was at the Stitcher Awards in San Francisco 2 days ago. And when The Moth and This American Life and Radiolab, these NPR podcasts were announced at the awards, there were just screams and whoops like it was Beatlemania.
Oh, yeah.
And when Risk came up there, people were just kind of like, huh? So, you know, we're still...
But you got an award?
No, The Moth did.
Oh, okay.
We're still at that place where, you know, even though podcasts are the part of the do-it-yourself revolution, we're still at the place where all the attention is going to the ones that have millions of dollars of backing by big corporate like entities.
Right.
So, I mean, what I pride myself on about Risk is that the quality, the production quality, is right up there with those other shows.
Yeah.
It's the fact that the content is a lot more just completely unfiltered and surprisingly real that people have to learn from listening to the show.
Yeah, for sure. Like some of the stories you were telling me that was being told last night here in Seattle. Your first Seattle Live show. Congratulations.
First Seattle Live show. And my gosh, I couldn't have been happier. It was so funny because in San Francisco is a city that we're used to coming to now.
Right.
So,
and you were just at Sketchfest too, right?
Yeah. Once, what I've found with Risk is we usually rely on fans of the podcast to bring us into their town.
Right.
And set us up with some sort of, bar or something where we can do it.
Yeah.
Then once we know people in town, we start to get to know people who are like, oh, no, you should actually be at this other place. So in San Francisco, we were at this palatial place that sat 400 and, you know, all the seats are red velvet and yada, yada.
Yeah.
And then we came here to Seattle and we are in this punk rock dive bar.
The Highline.
Yeah, they said it was a heavy metal vegan bar is the way that they described it. Like, yeah, sure.
God damn it.
But anyway, it was still, regardless of the fact that we're in this dive bar, which actually feels more appropriate to Risk and the way that we talk, you know?
Yeah.
It was like a packed house, totally warm reception.
And right.
Lots of people were fans of the podcast. So when the show goes from ridiculously obscene and X-rated and hilarious to, oh my gosh, there's a serial murderer in this story, or oh my gosh, someone's a being molested in this story. Like,
yeah.
That's the thing about Risk is that it from one story to the next, you have no idea where it's going to go emotionally.
Right, right.
Sometimes on the podcast, it's so intense that we do have to include a trigger warning. We do have to say,
yeah, you got to say case, you got to come in right. before the story yeah, happens. Yeah, and
in
say,
case you know people are out there listening who have been raped or have right, experienced right. a murder in the family or something like that.
Yeah,
but we still do love it when the podcast can go from ridiculously outrageous to holy crap. Yeah.
Shit just got real. Yeah. 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 So how did this whole thing start for you, man? Like, where did being in the entertainment industry enter your life?
Well, you know, I went to NYU with the goal of becoming a film director, and that's where I met everyone in the state.
Right.
Half of us, the state was the sketch comedy group that I was in, and after college, we were hired immediately onto MTV. So we were kind of an anomaly. We were like kids who didn't realize just quite how spoiled and lucky we were, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, half of us at NYU were, half of the guys in the group were film students, and the other half were acting students.
Yeah.
And
so you were a film student.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And okay. We all, you know, really planned on having careers in the arts. It's just that, you know, within a couple of months at NYU, I realized, oh shit, I should never be behind a camera. You know, I'm like, I don't have the technical, and I realized I should be a writer and an actor, but I didn't want to tell my folks, oh, you're spending all this money and we've got all these scholarships and I'm in the wrong program. So I just stuck through with it and took a lot of extracurriculars in writing and acting.
Was it ever in your thoughts that you would do something like sketch comedy or improv or anything like that?
I had grown up being the class clown. Comedy uh-huh. was a huge part of my personality from when I was a tiny kid, because one of the first things I was consciously aware of as a kid was that I was gay. I you know, when I was about 3 or 4 years old, I started to put together that I was attracted to boys, and I was able to start putting together that that was called gay and fag, and that that was, you know, the worst thing you could possibly be. So, like so many comedians, I started developing comedy as a defense mechanism.
Right.
I felt like, oh my God, I'm really, really weird inside, to the extent that people might hate me and ostracize me and I might lose my friends and family. So why don't I learn a way to come out as being weird that everyone can be comfortable with?
Right.
And that's comedy.
Then when you say you're gay, people would just be like, ah, makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. right. Oh, yeah, he's weird in another way. Exactly. So, and ultimately, that's what Risk is about, too.
Yeah, yeah.
The show is about encouraging people to come out about anything.
Right.
So I became kind of a comedic kid and was always very interested in theater and stuff like that.
Did that get you into trouble?
Oh, God, yeah, because I was a big prankster. I was the guy who took all his clothes off at parties in high school and, you know, loved things like streaking and, like, leaving things.
You took it that far.
Oh, yeah. I was, in fact, streaking through parties was kind of the way I auditioned for the state. When I was at NYU.
Yeah.
See, I always had this Jekyll and Hyde thing going on, because I was this kid from Ohio who was raised in a very, very Catholic family.
Okay, so your family was very conservative.
Yeah. Well, no, not politically conservative.
Okay.
They were good, like, diehard liberal Democrat, like, you know, marched in the marches that Dr. King was in and all kind of stuff. Yeah.
Wow.
So they were like from the left, but still they were 1950s Catholics from Cincinnati. So gay was not a part of the agenda, you know, that was still way out there for them. So Yeah, when I got to NYU, there was this perception that everyone had that, he's the bland, good Catholic boy from Ohio. And I decided I have to start getting drunk and doing really, really crazy shit.
This was a conscious decision?
It absolutely was. It absolutely, because the group had done their,
I love that.
They had done their first show in my freshman year. The first new group, the state used to be called the New Group. In college, and the first show was called I'm Rubber, You're Glue.
Okay.
And I saw it, and I was just like, it was the weirdest thing, because it was one of those nights where you feel like, oh, something's happening in my life, something's happening in this room. Like, there was this electricity in that audience where it felt like we were all watching like Monty Python, like we were watching a classic sketch comedy group that had been around for a while and that everyone knew, but it was the group's first night of doing their first show.
Yeah.
So there was some deja vu weirdness there, and I was like, I think I'm meant to be in that group.
It just clicked.
Yeah. So I started making sure I was getting into the same classes as those guys, and then making sure I was hanging out with them, and then making sure I was getting drunk and running around nude at their parties. Until they were finally like, you're crazy.
Come on over. Yeah. Now I heard a weird story in my minimum research that I do on everybody that comes on this show, which is like maybe, you know, 2 or 3 minutes of watching a YouTube video or something, you know, and then me getting bored and playing more solitaire and Sudoku. But like, I heard a great story that you actually were interested in another guy in the state.
Yeah.
And so you were following him around, and that's one of the reasons that you found that group, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell that story? Because that is just fantastic.
Yeah, the way that I first, like, I wouldn't have been introduced to that group of people in the first place if it hadn't been in the first, like, I would say week or two at NYU.
Yeah.
I saw Joe Latrullio walking through the hallways.
Very handsome man.
Yeah, he's now on what's it called? Brooklyn Nine-Nine, right?
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that show yet. I've heard great things.
So anyway, I saw Joe walking through the hallways, and I was like, oh my god, that guy is so hot. I was like, I just want to, you know, at that age. I guess it was a time also where you couldn't just ask anyone if they were gay or
It
was all
Were you out at this
point? No. Okay. So it was all still very closeted and secretive, and you know, you could get very carried away in your mind about the whole idea that someone might be gay and just wasting your time.
Well, it's the same thing for a straight person. Let me just put that out there, because I spent many, many years daydreaming about women being into me, and it never worked out. So
it's a safe space to be in the fantasy land.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, I was like, oh my gosh, I want to make sure I get into the classes that guy's in, just to be able to look at him.
That's fantastic.
And then I'm walking down the halls one day, and I notice he's waiting in the drop ad. He's in this line of seats outside a counselor's office, waiting to do drop a class and add a class. So I was like, oh my gosh, if I eavesdrop on him, if I sit in one of those chairs and kind of listen in to what he's telling the counselor he wants to drop and add, I'll just add that class. I'll walk in right after him and get in that class. So that's what I did. I got into his class of Motion, Matter, and Meaning, which was a film, you know, an early freshman year film class. And that's where I met Joe and Michael Jan. So the three of us started making movies together, along with another guy in our sophomore year. And that became important to the state, because some of the movies that we were making started being in the state's sketch shows.
Really?
It all worked out great. But, but like within like literally the first class or so, I figured out that Joe was completely straight.
But you still ended up, you know, being good with him.
It was a great example of like your cock leading you to better things. Like, which, how often does that happen? It's usually leading the wrong way.
Yeah, exactly. Usually end up in this hotel with crabs, right? Back in 1994.
Exactly.
So when did you come out?
Well, I came out to myself at 12 because of the movie E.T.
Really?
Yeah. I saw the movie.
Do tell.
It's funny, you know, there is a story on that I've told on Risk about how when I was in fifth grade, so I don't even know how old that is. When I was in fifth grade, I did attempt for about a week or two to date a girl and then had a dream of kissing the boy next door and realized, gosh, I'm really... I'm up against something here. I can't, I'm battling this. But I was raised Catholic, so I thought that maybe I could do some sort of novenas. I remember going through a period of like praying the rosary and saying, I'm going to go to confession and like get this, work this out of me.
Right.
But when I was 12, and so I guess it was around about when I was 12 when I was thinking, yeah, that's what I've got to do. I've got to gradually work this out of me and find the right woman and yada, yada, yada. But then I saw the movie E.T., and it's about the beginning of the movie. It's all about how this kid doesn't have a father and it doesn't really have many best friends and is kind of lonely and kind of needs a soulmate best friend sort of character.
Yeah.
And I thought that the kid was adorable. I like had a crush on this kid, this Elliot kid in E.T. And then...
Did you just remember something?
It's just that the movie is about this friendship.
Yeah,
but
I
guess in my whatever transferential thing going on in my brain, I guess I'm putting myself in the place of this little brown alien.
Oh, God.
I kind of saw the movie as being a little bit more of a love story and wished this strange, weird thing from outer space so I could be having a relationship with this boy. So anyway,
this is really deep for like a 11-year-old. Seriously, this is like when I was 11. I was like, "Where am I going to find my next Micro Machines?" Right.
Well, that's the thing. I heard Mike Daisy talk about this recently, and I was like, "Oh my God, that is so horribly, terrifyingly true."
Yeah.
Is that smart kids that are particularly smart or particularly self-aware, think, oh, I'm really special. I've really got myself figured out. I'm really in tune to a lot of things. I'm going to be a brilliant adult. But he's like, but no, you just grow up and then everyone else catches up.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's totally true, too. Yeah.
So it's like you were just traumatized by knowing too much too soon. But no, when BT was saying goodbye to Elliot, I was in tears, and I knew everyone else was in tears too. But I was like, this is too much. I'm crying because I feel like I'm losing my fake lover, who's a boy, and yada yada. So I bought the novelization of it, and I remember being in a Holiday Inn with my parents. We were on vacation, and getting to a certain point in the book where I'm reading about this boy, Elliot, and just getting overwhelmed and wanting to cry again, and putting the book down and saying, "Okay, that's it. I'm gonna say it out loud, I am gay." So that was coming out to myself. Uh-huh. And it was, I think that I may have still had this plan to, but maybe I can still change it. But really, I think that I was already, you know, that by saying it out loud, I was basically saying, you know what, fuck it. I've heard all these things about how maybe people can change, but fuck it. This is what I am. So,
were you going to public school or like
no,
Catholic school?
No, I was raised very, very Catholic in grade school and then went to a Jesuit school for high school.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I was for a while there, I was kind of being groomed to be a Jesuit, you know?
Right,
yeah.
Like
my parents were even talking to some of the Jesuits about how, maybe he can, after school, go off to the seminary and yada. Yeah. So I being that aware of it that young did make me super aware of this whole idea of hiding and coming out about stuff that I'm still obsessed with to this day.
Yeah.
And also it made me very aware of some other things that we're told all kinds of things. You're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to say that. There's a lot of shame and stuff like that around social conventions, and everyone has to kind of, as an individual, begin to take a better look at how do I really feel about that? You know, right down to the goddamn Ten Commandments. You know what I mean? Like saying, I mean, there's a certain point where a kid, if he's realizing, okay, everyone says that being gay is the worst thing you can possibly be. If that's true, what else of the Ten Commandments or whatever else might not be true? So yeah, it starts to make you a real, like, free thinker in a certain way. And I think that's a good thing, to be tackling that stuff, questioning stuff. Yeah.
Were you afraid of what your family would think about
Absolutely. I thought that... I always thought that my dad, just because of his very, very accepting, he has a lot of empathy and he's just a very, very forgiving kind of person. I always thought that he would ultimately be fine. But my mom has a real puritanical streak in her. Sex is something that makes her incredibly uncomfortable to have it mentioned in any way. And she's just one of those people who's like worried about what the neighbors might think and all that kind of stuff. So I think she sensed that I was different as a kid and was kind of dumping shame on me in certain ways. Like, don't walk like that. And stop using so much of your facial expressions when you talk. That
kind
of stuff.
Don't fling your wrist to the side.
So actually, when I started Risk... A part of me was pretty aware that what I was doing was, on an archetypical level, like a psychological level, saying, fuck you, mom. You know what I mean? I was basically saying, all right, I'm 40 now.
This is fighting back.
Yeah.
Right,
You know, you get to a certain point where you're like, okay, obviously there are some things that I'm not going to say on the podcast so as not to really, really hurt someone.
Yeah.
Or some things that... You know, maybe I'll work on in stories and have them be released posthumously in case it might seriously hurt my career or something. But for the most part, at 40, I was like, come on, I'm becoming an adult. And it seems like not being myself has hurt me for all the years since the state had broken up.
Yeah.
Someone was just at the Risk show in San Francisco. I think it was Dana Gould said, Los Angeles is a place that people go to... because they don't want to be themselves. And so that there's just all this fucking psychosis in that town.
Yeah.
Because everyone wants to just pretend they're someone else. And, you know, some people are good at that and actually, you know, end up succeeding. And then other people like me are just like, well, I've got certain talents, but I'm a fucking weirdo, you know? I'm not going to fit into their cookie-cutter stereotypes of what they want, you know? And I think that Maren, Mark Maren started his podcast at the same time as Risk started. So it was really kind of a wonderful thing because he did Risk for our first show.
Oh, cool.
And, well, actually, I was on his show, but he lost the goddamn file.
Oh.
But anyway... one of the things I always found so inspiring about Mark was I used to, you know, watch Mark do his thing at Luna Lounge back in the day in the 90s after the state had broken up and thought, gosh, this guy's a damn dynamo. But where does he fit in? He's so, I don't know, neurotic and kind of angry and just idiosyncratic in a way that I couldn't see middle America enjoying, because that's all we had ever heard on,
which
you
at
know,
that time too was the bread and butter of stand-up comedy.
Everything
had to be very, very blue at that point.
You know, it was interesting because when we were at MTV and then later a lot of our friends started working at Comedy Central, they just obsessively told us, what would 18 to 25-year-old white males in the Midwest get? That's what we need. That's the focus grouping we have to do for all of the humor.
Right.
And even though a lot of us were 18 to 25-year-old white males from the Midwest, we were just like, fuck that. We just want to do whatever we find funny.
We
can't be thinking about that in order to adjust how we're doing things. And some people to some extent figured it out, but I never did. I've just never been able to corral a career that much toward the tastes of the industry, so Mark created this show, WTF, his podcast, and where he could be totally himself and not have to worry about what corporate entities might think. And then all of a sudden, corporate entities are like, oh, everyone likes this weirdo. Let's give him a show.
There's a lot of fucking weirdos out there.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's what I love about the whole podcasting thing is you can establish your own style that has no one's thumbprint on it.
Yeah.
And find a following.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Let's do this, Kevin. Let's take a short musical break here and then, we'll come back and we'll talk with Kevin Allison more here on the Air Raid Podcast. Weird.
Yeah, Jesus Christ.
Did you ever meet him in your
travels? I never met him, but good Lord. The state, our manager, Steve Starr, made a movie that was one of Hoffman's first movies.
Really?
And so I remember, in order to hire Steve Starr, we were like, well, what have you done? And he's like, well, I just made this movie. And I remember all of us saying, that was a kind of crappy movie. But the guy who played his assistant, which should have been just any fucking role, you know,
it should have been, here's
your coffee, sir. We were like, that guy was really interesting.
Yeah.
How often do you say that about that kind of a role in a movie? It's fucking...
That's super. Upsetting. That is very sad. That's very sad. Well, let's move away from the sadness and talk a little bit more. I would love to find out more about the state because growing up, I never had cable. Mm. But when that show came on in 1994, right?
I think 93 is when we started working on You Wrote It, You Watch It with Jon Stewart. So I guess 94 might have been when the state itself went on. Yeah.
Yeah. When that started coming out, and the friends who had television, the lucky kids, in my hometown, started talking about this show on MTV, I felt very left out. And then I saw my first sketch, which was the I'm going to dip my balls in it guy at a party, right? And I was blown away by what you guys were doing because they weren't doing that kind of stuff on SNL. They weren't doing that kind of stuff on the local show Almost Live.
Yeah.
That was done
for years.
And I was like, holy shit, this is what sketch comedy should be.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny that you mention Almost Live because the one of the producers of Almost Live, Jim Sharp, is the guy that we ended up hiring as our producer at MTV. Yeah, yeah.
Really?
So we watched several episodes of Almost Live, and we hired Jim because we felt like he was a good guy who seemed to get us and was really, really, really determined to work on a show that had something fresh going on. What, absolutely, like, it's very similar to what we were saying about with Risk. With both Risk and The State, I've felt the same way, which is that in order to really get it, you have to see a bit of it. You have to be exposed to, you know, a couple episodes of it, because there is a specific kind of creative energy there that is really, really kind of nuanced to the attitudes and personalities of young kids who are smart in the, you know, in the 90s. So kids who have seen SNL and have seen Monty Python and are already way ahead of the game as far as what the networks think people are going to get, you know?
Yeah.
We were, you know, we were just a bunch of really smart kids who were good in, you know, English class and had taken a lot of acting and stuff like that. And and loved joking around and loved when we did joke around for that joking to become more and more abstract, more and more referential to tropes of comedy that we found, you know, tired. Like, for example, Louis is the perfect example of that. It was literally us attacking SNL.
Right.
And at that, and maybe at that point, Mad TV. It was us saying...
Were you on at the same time as Mad TV?
Yeah, yeah. Mad TV started, I think, like halfway through our run. But yeah, it was us saying, people, you know, how many sketches can you watch in which a character just breaks out the same tagline over and over?
Yeah, yeah.
And what was funny about it, and I guess we should have foreseen this, is that a lot of people saw Louis, that character, didn't get, and they loved it just because it's a guy saying his tagline over and over.
Yeah.
But I think most of our fans got it. It's ridiculous that that's all this guy does.
Right, right. Now, were you guys on at the same time? Because right after I said that, that there were these other shows like SNL and Mad TV and Almost Live weren't doing what you guys were doing. There was a show that was doing something similar, and that was In Living Color. But they didn't. I don't think they crossed that boundary as much as you guys did. And is that something with like network, you know, network TV versus cable TV?
I think
it's
so.
Gotta be, right?
I think so. I mean, you know, what's interesting about In Living Color is like that is a case, I think, where a network, because when we went to CBS, we were told that, oh, we should have some more people of color in the cast, and that we should try to start really incorporating the cultural sensibility of people of color.
Okay.
And for us as a group at that time, we were just like, well, we are who we are. We're kind of an organically, we're friends who met. We have a certain chemistry. So while we understand that there's, you know, great importance to multiculturalism and everything like that, if you want a unique voice in comedy, you should just take us as we are, because just like the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or whoever, there's something special about who we are when we're together as these personalities.
Yeah, yeah.
But shows like In Living Color or Mad TV, they were, or SNL, put together by producers who are saying, okay, here's the black guy, here's the Asian woman, yada yada, and we should try to address this pop culture trend that's going on, yada yada. So the extent to which those shows actually end up funny is really kind of what can fall through the cracks. You know, it, whether or not the writers do really get along with the actors and there's a lot of, you know, simpatico there, then some magic stuff can happen.
Yeah, yeah.
But while The State was on, SNL was notorious for the writers not even talking to the actors on the show at that point. And, like, just this, it just felt like this enormous machine with tons of money where it was just not an organic thing where a bunch of friends were making the kind of jokes that they wanted to make. It was very much a cookie cutter sort of show. Now I think SNL has a lot more energy and originality.
I was going to say, I watched it last night for probably the first time in about 10 years. And it was pretty great. Like, and I think I probably won't watch it again for like 10 years. Because I know that I'm going to see, like, you know, you see when you don't watch something for 10 years, then all of a sudden there's a whole new cast. And you're like, oh, okay, I haven't seen that character before. But I think, like, I keep on feeling like they're just going to fall right back into what they were doing, you know, the last time I saw the show, which was a sketch that I had seen. The same sketch like 2 years prior.
I think that one, I mean, I don't want to sound like too arrogant or tooting my own
horn. And I, yeah, I don't want to bash on a show that a lot of people like either. It's just my,
but I think that one of the things that happened is that a lot of younger people started being involved in that show. And I think that those younger people under, because I know a lot of them actually, I think a lot of them understood, oh, hey, UCB is really special because of the people in it. The State is really special because of the people in it. Let's try to bring more, you know, of everyone hanging out, socializing, getting along, like, and really, like, kind of creating a group mind sort of thing. I think that some of that got into SNL kind of despite Lorne Michaels' way of doing things, you know?
So is that how you're, so The State functioned completely opposite of SNL is what it sounds like. I mean, you guys all got along really well. And
oh, well, there was a hell of a lot of tension. I mean, we're
was it competitive?
Oh, very, very. Okay. I mean, we're like a family, in, you know, in a very dysfunctional family. Like, love the hell out of each other and fight like hell over everything. It's very hard to get us to agree on something right away. And the, I think the worst thing about The State is that we were supposed to be this sort of egalitarian democracy, right? I mean, that was the idea from the very beginning. But there are several members of the group who have always felt, you know, no, it's okay if 10 people agree on something. And I am the only one who disagrees, and I insist we're not going forward. I don't know how the hell that works with some of the folks in the group, but it does.
I've been finding as I'm getting older that that exists everywhere. Like, there are, you know, 40-year-old children walking this earth. In every you know, faction of society. I mean, it's just unbearable sometimes. Do you still run into a lot of that? Like, I mean, I would imagine that the entertainment industry, even the section of entertainment that you are in now too, it's got to be very competitive, right?
Yes, absolutely. But I think that everyone in the group mellowed out as they, everyone in The State mellowed out as they got older. I think we all began to see, oh, you don't have to feel like everyone, like if someone else is being funny on stage right now, I have to be jealous of them and yada yada. Like, you start to be able to recognize, oh, I can be supportive of other comedians, and I can just kind of appreciate that a lot of this shit is really unpredictable. I mean, you know, a perfect example is like Zach Galifianakis. It's so funny because when, after The State broke up, the scene was Luna Lounge on Ludlow Street in the Lower East Side. That's where everyone was trying out their stuff. And I remember the day this little kid came up to me and he was like, oh my God, are you Kevin Allison from The State? I love you guys. And it was Zach. And he just wanted to get as much advice as he could from me. And I remember thinking, oh, he's a really sweet kid. You know, that's nice. It's nice that kids are enthusiastic. But I didn't think anything of it. Then I saw his first bit that he did at Luna Lounge. And it was miserable. And no one was laughing. And I was like, oh, shit. Kid's going nowhere. And then years later, I'm like, well, holy fuck. fuck? You know, like Zach really put it together.
Right.
But everyone I talk to is like, could any of us have predicted that Zach would be one of the ones that would go on to be, you know, it's the industry is really, really strange and unpredictable. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily about talent or about how hard you work. There's a lot about just how many people you're good friends with, really.
Right.
And how often you're showing up. And then, unfortunately, just frickin' luck. Just like things lining up at the right time.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really frustrating to try to figure out how or why it works sometimes.
Well, and to keep it going, too, right?
Yeah,
hard, right?
Eventually, you have to do what I think I've done, and that is find a way to be doing something that, if it's just making just enough money, it's rewarding enough for your soul and you believe in it enough to be like... And I don't know that I would feel that way if I was doing just purely silly, abstract comedy. You know, the nice thing about Risk is it is sometimes insanely funny, but then it can be a lot of other things as well.
Right.
And I think that that really sustains me because I get these reactions from people saying, holy shit, dude, I was thinking of committing suicide. Then I started listening to your podcast and started thinking, shoosh, other people have been through some terrible things too, or I'm not such a freak, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's very, very, very rewarding and keeps me going.
That's pretty great.
Yeah.
That's pretty great.
Yeah.
So when did your career take the shift into where you are now? Because you dabble in a couple different things. You teach.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. NYU,
I want to say?
I taught a little bit at NYU, cinema studies stuff there. Yeah, basically what happened was after the state broke up, I spent about, you know, 11 or 12 years in the wilderness, you know, like cater waitering.
Okay, not physically in like the
oh,
Cascade
no, no,
range.
No, not physically in the whale. I mean like in the belly of the whale.
Okay.
Yeah, no. It was just odd job after odd job to survive, which is exhausting and gives you very little time to actually be creative.
Uh-huh.
And then also just, you know, pitching shows to Comedy Central or auditioning for things or just things were just not going anywhere. I was doing a lot of character monologues on stage. I was getting up on stage and doing like solo sketch comedy where it's just me as a kooky character talking for 10 minutes. But it wasn't until I did a show, five characters, it was called F Up, five characters who had F'd up their careers, which is how I felt at that time, because by that time, no one even remembered who I was.
Right, right.
And I was still pretty destitute. And I did that show at San Francisco Sketch Fest, actually, in 2008, and Michael Ian Black was there. And afterwards, I said, what'd you think? And he said, I think everyone just wanted you to drop the act and be yourself. And I said, yeah, but I'm too gay and too kinky and too abstract and too absurdist and too all these things that don't make sense together.
Yeah.
It feels too risky. And he said, that's the word. If it feels risky, you're opening up and they'll open up. So give that a try. So I did, and it changed everything.
Yeah. And so that's when you started your teaching and things like that?
Well, I had done some sketch comedy teaching before then, and that was actually what taught me that there are forums in which you can be all those things, in which you can. Like when I first started teaching sketch comedy in, I think that was 2005, at a place called Media Bistro in New York, it was just a fan of the show. It was like, hey, would you like to teach sketch comedy? So I came, and of course, everyone who was taking the class were fans of the state.
Yeah, yeah.
And in front of that audience, all of a sudden, I was like, oh, I can be really friendly and Midwestern and polite, you know, like I tend to be. And then in the next moment, I can be ridiculously raunchy and absurdist, and people are going with me the whole time. They're appreciating me for all the weird little idiosyncrasies of my character. So I think that teaching actually opened me up to the whole idea of being myself on stage.
And so did that kind of bring you out of your, obviously that kind of brought you out of your funk.
It did. It was Risk. When I first came up with this idea to call a show Risk, so it would be like The Moth or This American Life, except that you could say anything.
Mm-hmm.
everyone, like, when they first heard about it, was like, oh, I want to do that show, or, oh, that sounds good. So it kind of had the wind at its back from the very beginning. It felt like kind of a zeitgeisty thing.
Yeah.
And so right from the beginning, we were having people like Margaret Cho and Janine Garofalo and Sarah Silverman and folks like that were doing the show. And so I was very fortunate that it people liked the idea and it really picked up quick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great, man.
Yeah.
Well, I'm happy that everything's going well.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. It's been a real treat getting to talk with you.
Thanks, and don't forget at CVS they have plenty of RID and whatever else they call those crabs medicines.
the little combs that I have to take to my pubes now. Yeah, yeah.
I'm just surprised there's no blood spatters on the walls.
It's really not that bad. They have done wonders with this place.
No, it's great. It's a good place. It's been a very nice day.
good. So what's coming up for the show? Are you doing? Are you off to do another live?
Yeah,
live
well,
risk
what,
here pretty
the,
soon or what?
We're going to be in Dallas next weekend. But,
okay,
but what's exciting is that we're going to London and Paris this year too.
Oh,
yeah,
awesome!
Yeah,
awesome.
So
great. We've got some listeners over there. So when is it? And do you know the dates?
You know, the London show is going to be the week of July 4th. That's all I can remember. I don't remember the exact date. But and the Paris show, we have yet to figure out when exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
That'll be fun. Have you ever done any, like, overseas shows like that?
I did in Amsterdam once,
oh, okay,
and that was wonderful. And it was also a completely debaucherous week.
Sure. Just knowing the little bit about you that I do now is like, okay, yeah. We don't have to go that far into detail, Kevin. No, thank you so much, man. It's been a real honor meeting you and getting a chat.
Thank you. This is great.
All right, man. All right, welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that. I know I did. It was really great to get to meet Kevin and chat with him for a little while. Very weird finding out that that Philip Seymour Hoffman is dead. Once again, very, very sad times. Hey, just want to and straight into a plug to end the show right after talking about how sad I am. Whatever, right? Yeah. Hey, thanks for listening this week, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Remember, let's see, live show coming up March 29th, Saturday, March 29th at 9 p.m. at Naked City Brewery. And great food and beer there as well. So look them up, won't you? They're wonderful, wonderful sponsors of the show. Also, if you're interested in, let's say you're just hearing this show for the first time, go to our website, www.air-raid.net, and click on the archives page, and you can find all sorts of shows with people like Macklemore, Pete Holmes, Dana Gould, Bob Saget, lots and lots of interviews there, 182 interviews for you to peruse, Mudhoney, the President of the United States of America. Let's see, Chris Walla from Death Cab for Cutie, all sorts of stuff there, you guys. Yeah, music and comedy. That's what we specialize in. All right. Everybody, have a great week. I hope you had a great Super Bowl Sunday, and I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful week. We'll be back. We'll be back next week with this guy, Ben Fisher. Great musician coming out with a new album, and can't wait to share that with you. So, tune in next week, all new episode with Ben Fisher. This is the band Neighbors with the song Muscle Girl on Muscle Beach. I hope you enjoy it. Check them out as well. There's a link to their website on our website. So, yeah, there you go. Okay, Muscle Girl on Muscle Beach by Neighbors. And have a great week, everybody. We love you.